This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, in for Terry Gross. Our first guest, Alexander Payne, directed and co-wrote the films Election, About Schmidt, Sideways, and The Descendants. He's directed Jack Nicholson and George Clooney in starring roles, and has won 2 Oscars for Best Adapted Screenplay. His new film, Nebraska, stars Bruce Dern, who won the Best Actor Award at this year's Cannes Film Festival. Nebraska just received 6 Independent Spirit Award nominations, including Best Feature and Best Director. Payne spoke with Terry last Monday. Bruce Dern plays Woody, an old man who is beginning to show signs of dementia, which may be why he falls for one of those junk mail sweepstakes scams and actually believes that he's won $1 million. He's convinced that all he needs to do to collect his money is show up at the address in Lincoln, Nebraska that's mentioned in the mailing. That won't be easy, because he lives in Billings, Montana, and can no longer drive. So he starts walking. Will Forte, a former cast member of Saturday Night Live, plays his son, who eventually decides to humor his father and drive him to Lincoln. They make various stops along the way, including to his father's hometown. Here's a scene from early in the film, after a cop finds Woody walking on the highway, starting his trek to Nebraska. Woody's son has come to pick him up at the police station and wants to know what's going on.
So you told the sheriff that you were walking to Nebraska?
That's right. To get my $1 million.
What $1 million?
We are now authorized to pay $1 million to Woodrow T. Grant of Billings, Montana.
Let me see that.
And your mother won't take me.
Mega sweepstakes marketing. Dad, this is a total come-on. It's one of the oldest gimmicks in the book. I didn't even know they still did it anymore.
Well, I can't say it if it's not true.
They're just trying to sell you magazines.
It says I won.
So mail it in. I'll help you.
I'm not trusting the mail with $1 million.
That's a scene from Nebraska. Alexander Payne, welcome to Fresh Air and congratulations on the film.
Thanks very much.
So what interested you in the idea of somebody actually taking one of these sweepstakes come-ons at face value?
I thought it would be a nice premise for a little comedy. And I didn't come up with that premise. It came with the screenplay. It's the first one I've directed. It's the first film I've made with a screenplay. I didn't originate. I did a rewrite on it shortly before shooting. But it was the basic premise, the entryway into this whole story. I actually thought it was a bit specious to begin with, because the writer thought of it 10 years ago when he originally wrote the script, when Publishers Clearinghouse was still more ubiquitous, and now it isn't. Now it's largely Nigerians emailing us for the scams. So I had to put a line of dialogue in, which is, I didn't know they still did this anymore.
You thought it would be a good premise for a comedy. The film is kind of a comedy, but it's kind of not a comedy, too. It's like both, like several of your films. It's a combination of comedy and just a movie with a lot of heart and deep emotion, with characters who don't necessarily know how to express emotion.
But I approach them all as comedies, even The Descendants to some degree. But this one really, I mean, when I was reading this script, I read it as a comedy. Oh, this will be funny. This will be fun to direct. But then with moments of gravity or realism to anchor it in our world. But I'm thinking more about the comic potential.
The journey that they go on to, quote, like redeem the sweepstakes certificate, which the son knows is just a scam, it becomes this like opportunity for the son to better know his father, to the extent that the father is capable of revealing anything about himself. There's a really nice scene in a bar between the father and the son early in the movie. And the father's like a real drinker, and he's acting like he's really not, but he still is. And the son's girlfriend, his live-in girlfriend, has just walked out on him because he was unwilling to actually commit. And she wants to, like, either look, we're on or we're off. Which is it? Make up your mind. So she's just walked out. So the son's unhappy about that. He's sitting at the bar with his father, trying to communicate with him. And here's an excerpt of that scene.
I didn't tell you that Noel and I broke up.
Who?
Noel? You're the girl I've been living with for the past 2 years? She moved out. We broke up.
Oh.
Maybe I should have asked her to get married. I don't know. I just never felt sure, you know what I mean? I mean, how are you supposed to know when you're sure? Are you sure?
Huh?
How did you and Mom end up getting married?
She wanted to.
You didn't?
I figured what the hell.
Were you ever sorry you married her?
All the time. Could have been worse.
Well, you must have been in love. At least at first.
Never came up.
That line always gets a big laugh. Are you ever sorry you married her? Yeah, all the time. Somehow audiences think that's really funny.
I think it's even funnier that never came up.
Never came up, yeah.
Because the Bruce Dern character, the father, is so uncommunicative in this. And he's a man with, if he has an inner life, he's unable to express anything about it. And for a son who's trying to get to know him, it's like, it's impossible. It's like talking to an inanimate object sometimes. I mean, he just won't express himself.
I think many of us have experiences with fathers who are there, they're loving, they're nice, but somehow they're on another planet. And you wonder your whole life, what is that planet that my father is on?
So I have to ask you, there's a scene when Bruce Dern and Will Forte are on the road together heading toward Nebraska, and they're passed on the highway by a bunch of bikers. Was that an homage to Bruce Dern's film, The Wild Angels?
No, I hadn't thought about that until you mentioned it right now. I was just thinking,
because he plays a biker in that.
Correct. Yeah, yeah. No, that was trying to make South Dakota seem real. Because when you drive through South Dakota, you always see a lot of bikers.
Fair enough.
And that was the single most expensive shot in the film.
Why?
It goes by quickly. Well, I thought, we're in South Dakota. We'll just get some bikers to drive by the car. And the studio said, no way, Jose.
Why?
That insurance liability. You've got three moving parts. You've got the hero car, the car with the actors, a bunch of bikers, and we were in a moving vehicle behind shooting. And so they said, you have to fly in stuntmen from Los Angeles and rent the bikes and rent the costumes, and they will pretend to be bikers. And we did the numbers, and that was about a $50,000 hit on a very small budget, which I couldn't afford from the budget. So I actually had to make a special appeal to the studio. Will you give me $50,000 extra to get that one shot? And bless their hearts, they said yes.
I have a directing question for you, but in order to get to the question, we have to hear a clip. And the clip is an excerpt of an interview I did with Margot Martindale, the wonderful actress who a lot of people might know as Hilary Swank's mother in the Clint Eastwood movie. Why am I blanking out on the name? Million Dollar Baby. And also, she was terrific in Justified as this, like, Kentucky woman who runs this, like, kind of drug business. So anyway, so you were directing her. It's a film called Parish Atem. And this was like an anthology film. There's several sequences in it, several separate stories. Each story is directed and written by different people. So the one that you did stars Margot Martindale. And the story here is she's taking like an adult education course in French. And she decides to go to France alone. And it's not the exciting romantic trip to France that everybody hopes for, because she's still just alone and she doesn't really know French culture. She's not really sure how to get around. But at the end, she's sitting on a bench in a park watching the children play and watching other people, you know, lovers go by and everything. She has this just like emotional moment of just seeing the beauty of life. And I just want to play you what she had to say about playing that scene.
I was sitting on a park bench and I went from looking at some old people on a bench and thinking of my mother and all the people that were gone to panning over to seeing a playground full of children and thinking of my daughter growing up. And it just was there, just immediately.
Oh. Well, I could see how it would be there because the emotion is still so there.
It's just, you know, it's all about life. It was so easy. I'm sorry. It was
so easy to do.
Yeah. And Alexander directed me as if he were directing a silent movie, which was fantastic. It was a perfect combination for me.
And that's the actress Margot Martindale talking about her final scene in the movie Paris Je T'aime, and she was directed by my guest Alexander Payne. And she had talked earlier in the interview about her mother dying, which is one of the things she was thinking about in that scene. She obviously had this really like authentic moment of emotion while playing that scene, and even while just thinking about that scene, she was very emotional. I was thinking about you directing her and wondering, like, say something happened so that you couldn't use that take. Say, like, somebody walked by unintentionally or something happened and you couldn't use that perfect take. What would you do? Because you probably had a sense that she had went, like, so deep and was so fully experiencing the moment in character. It would have been hard, I think, for her to – maybe it wouldn't be hard for her to go there again. Can you talk about that?
You see in that clip that she has very ready access to emotion. And that's
yes.
That's what the great actors have. And that's why life is often so difficult for them, because they can't keep their emotions tamped down.
That's so interesting. As
you and I can. So then if you can put an oil pump on that spurting oil well of emotion – then you can be a professional actor. And so I think we did 4 or 5 takes, and she was equally good in all of them. And it was just a matter of making sure the camera was right and the timing with the voiceover and so forth. But I clearly remember having 3 or 4 great takes to deal with. The good ones can keep it going. It's not just like, oh, one take where they really hit that emotion. Well, yeah, maybe. But let's try it again. The cameraman missed it. You know, or the assistant cameraman made your eyes out of focus or something. We need to do it again. Or I remember telling Paul Giamatti in Sideways, he was really at a deep place, and I had to say, okay, stop, Paul. Could you please rotate your head 12 degrees to the left? I mean, we all have to understand that film is technical as well as emotional.
So if it is true, that observation that you just made, that actors more readily tap into their emotions and that those emotions are always kind of gushing. And
absolutely.
That's responsible for some of the problems they often have in life.
Oh, yeah. And I think – sorry.
Yeah, no, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say there's a way in which I've observed that actors and directors envy each other. I think a director envies an actor's ready access to emotion and how beautiful that is. And I think actors can envy directors – dealing more clinically with emotions, ordering them about dispassionately.
Well, a lot of actors want to become the directors.
Well, good for them.
But anyways, getting back to that idea, knowing that for actors, emotions are often very close to the surface, does that mean you have to be really careful in how you interact with them so as not to, you know, unintentionally wound them or throw them off their game?
You mean while working with them or just in general in life?
I'll take both.
Well, then they're just oppressive to be around, which they can be. You have to be on eggshells or P's and Q's all the time, you know, around an actor because you might upset them. I mean, how fun is that?
is that what it's like for you?
No. I mean, I really enjoy working with actors. It's beautiful, if not pathetic sometimes. It's beautiful to see how fully they wish to give them themselves. And I've always been confused by people saying of a certain actor's performance, oh, it's so brave. What a brave performance. What I think, that's what they're there to do. They're there to do anything. It's not brave. I think it's the job. And it also should be coming from an attitude of fun and playfulness. And isn't it delightful to be doing this and to be expressing these emotions and going deeply, deeply into who we are and showing those of us who have less ready access to our emotions. And I often have to pay people to help us get in touch with our emotions, to show us what's available, what's beneath the surface. It's beautiful what they do.
When I was interviewing Bruce Dern recently about Nebraska, he said there's a scene where his son, played by Will Forte, convinces him to like go to the home that he grew up in, that the Bruce Dern character grew up in. And the Bruce Dern character is very unemotional. He shows, outside of being grumpy, he shows no emotion. But in going to this house, you could tell he's just experiencing the fact that his father used to whip him and that this is the place where his 2-year-old brother, who slept in the same bed as him, died in bed. And Bruce Dern said that you know, in our interview, that what he was thinking about was, he said, the fact that I didn't get any support when I was young. That's what you're seeing. And he also said, Alexander Payne didn't know that that's what I was thinking. Does it matter whether you know it or not?
Hell no. I'm not there to give an acting class. I'm there to make a movie. And I often don't know, nor do I often care to know, really what the actor is thinking about.
Do you want to know a lot about their past, or would you just as soon not know and keep
about
it?
About the actor's past?
The actor's past.
Why would I want to know about – I mean, I'm interested them in people, and we're working together, and – typically, I ask people around me, oh, who are you and where'd you from and where'd you grow up and, you know, those standard questions. I'm interested. But are you wondering if I'm interested so that I could know better what buttons to push in them or where they might be coming from?
Well, I know some directors like to do that. Some directors like to work with things, like personal things they know about the actor. And some directors don't.
I don't really think that way.
Mm-hmm.
My basic direction is – please hit your mark and recite your dialogue exactly as written. And you think I mean that somewhat facetiously, but actually my job, I feel, is basically done, not done, but on the way to being done when I've cast them. And that old cliche is very true. 90% of directing is casting, not just the actors, but the technicians, everyone involved in making a film. So in the moment we're doing a scene, and I work with intelligent actors, they know what the heck the scene's about. So, and they know what, without being too result-oriented in their thinking, they know what emotional state the character's in. I know sometimes I think that if I get too personal with a direction, you know, try doing this or think about that, I may mar what they're already thinking about.
Mm-hmm.
Like they might be thinking about something else, and here I am like – waltzing in and trying to give some brilliant emotional methody direction, and I might screw them up. So I'm very careful about that.
I was rewatching The Descendants in preparation for our interview and arrived at the same conclusion I did the first time I saw it. It's really a terrific film. And it stars George Clooney, whose wife is in a coma after a boating accident, and that leads him to find out a lot about her and about himself. And it's like other films of yours. It both has a lot of emotion and humor in it as well, and you manage to find a really nice balance. But I love the opening narration, and I think the opening narration just tells you everything you kind of need to know to get in the right frame of mind for the movie. And I'd like to play that opening narration, and this is George Clooney. And as we're hearing this opening narration on screen, we're seeing shots of life in Hawaii. So here's the opening voiceover from Alexander Payne's film, The Descendants.
My friends on the mainland think just because I live in Hawaii, I live in paradise. Like a permanent vacation. We're all just out here sipping Mai Tais, shaking our hips and catching waves. Are they insane? Do they think we're immune to life? How can they possibly think our families are less screwed up? Our cancers less fatal, our heartaches less painful. Hell, I haven't been on a surfboard in 15 years. For the last 23 days, I've been living in a paradise of IVs and urine bags and tracheal tubes. Paradise? Paradise can go f*** itself.
That's George Clooney's voiceover from the opening of The Descendants, directed by my guest, Alexander Payne. So you wrote that line, do they think we're immune to life?
Yeah.
I was wondering if you think some people have that thought about people in Hollywood, that they're immune to life because they make these like fabulous films and they live in a fabulous world and they have money and fabulous homes.
I don't know. I can't give a very good answer to that. I don't know.
What did you think when you were wanting to make movies and you were young?
I actually wasn't looking forward to it. But now that I do live part of the time in Los Angeles, I also live in Omaha, I like it. I've come to see it as a great, great city. And older Hollywood, because I'm a film buff, is fantastic. you know, you can trash living in Los Angeles or living in Hollywood, but I'm driving down the street and I turn and, oh, look, there's Vendome. There's the stairs that Laurel and Hardy carried the piano up in the music box. And here's the hero. I'm in Las Feliz. There's the house used in Double Indemnity. And it's just – it's delightful. And you think of the of what creation of culture for the world was created there in the teens and 20s and 30s and 40s. But I think about – silent comedy a lot and what was done, the brilliance of what our comic actors did in the 20s. And I'm filled with pride.
What do you love about silent movies?
First of all, let me say I'm no expert. I like silent films a lot, but I know people who are experts and I'm no expert. But my line about it is that, for example, they say that often a filmmaker's first film can be his or her best. Why? Because he or she has been waiting 30, 35 years to tell that story. So a lifetime of whatever it is, frustration or observation, or that all comes out. I feel the same way about cinema. I think that mankind had been looking for this magnificently verisimil art form which really mirrors life, and that the first 30 years of it, it all came out. And before it was harnessed to be really industrial and present a more reliable, predictable, marketable product, silent film from the get-go is just all over the place and often much more oniric, more dreamlike in its imagery, and taps into cinema's relationship with dream. And the excitement of creating cinema, creating a new art form.
Margot Martindale said you directed the scene that we were discussing earlier on the park bench as if it were a silent film. What does that mean?
I don't know exactly what she meant, but probably – and I direct a lot like this, which is talking through takes. So
– what does that mean?
The actor is acting and I'm coaching them through the performance moment by moment like they used to do, you know, in that cliche with the director with the jodhpurs and the megaphone. So I'm saying, oh, do this now, do this now. Look left, look right, look up, feel sad, cry, whatever.
Really? In the middle of the scene you're doing that?
Oh, yeah.
What if there's supposed to be dialogue?
Well, and now if there's dialogue, I might say if they don't get a line quite right, I might tell the camera, okay, keep rolling. Now try that line again, but do it this way. Stick to your guns a little bit more or whatever it is. I talk through takes a lot.
So this is a question from our associate producer Heidi, who is a filmmaker, and she's really wondering why you use dissolves sometimes.
What a lovely question. I like dissolves.
You should explain what a dissolve is.
A dissolve is a film technique, usually a transition from scene to scene where the image A begins to fade out, overlapped with the fade in of image B. And it's a technique which even predates cinema. It comes from magic lantern days, when they were doing slide to slide rather than having a cut, just a slam, they would do an overlap. It was more pleasing. Nowadays, you don't see too many dissolves in movies, and I never paid attention to when they went out of fashion. And Kevin Tent, my editor, and I think they're beautiful. I happen to be a big fan of Hal Ashby films in the 70s, and to my mind, he an ex-editor. Was a master of dissolves, and particularly long dissolves. For me, they lend emotion to a film, and there's a kind of a melancholy.
Alexander Payne, it's just been great to talk with you. Thank
you
so much.
Thanks a lot, Terry.
Alexander Payne speaking with Terry Gross last Monday. Payne directed the new film Nebraska. You can hear the entire interview, as well as Terry's recent conversation with the film's star, Bruce Dern, at our website, freshair.npr.org. Smartphones and social media have made it easier than ever for people to share photos of their friends, family, pets, and children. But sharing personal photos on the internet leads to issues of privacy. Fresh Air tech contributor Alexis Madrigal recently became a father and has some tips about how to navigate the world of online photo sharing.
This summer, I hit one of life's great milestones. I became a person who posts baby pictures on the internet. A lot of them. Our son was born in August, and I've already taken 15,000 pictures of him. Hundreds that I want to share with our family and close friends, and a few dozen that I might want to show to colleagues and acquaintances. But how? In theory, we're in a golden age of photo sharing. There are literally dozens of ways to share photos with friends now. But with the new capabilities of the internet come new and distinctly contemporary problems. For one, most parents don't want photographs of their children widely available. You want your people to see them, but not anyone else. The privacy issues that lurk in our daily lives cry out to be addressed when it comes to children. And second, not everyone uses the same social network. Grandma's on Facebook, your nephew's on Instagram, and your colleagues are on Twitter and LinkedIn. So what do my wife and I do? We've chosen not to post pictures to our very public Twitter and Facebook accounts because we don't want photos of our son accessible to just anyone, and Facebook's intensive data mining and ever-changing privacy policies make us uneasy. So for close friends, we've been uploading photos to Instagram. We like how simple and easy it is to use. And the interface feels intimate, I think, like just the place to give someone a peek into our new life. It helps that before posting anything, we locked our accounts and pruned our connections. We know every single follower we have, no strangers allowed. I also love Google Plus's photo tools. If you can only dimly recall, Plus is Google's would-be Facebook competitor. And while it stinks as a social network, its photo handling is excellent. It can back up all your phone photos to the cloud, and its default settings encourage privacy. One thing we love is that if you take a bunch of pictures with a similar background, say your baby on the changing table, Google Plus automatically turns that series into a cute little animation that can be easily shared with select groups of people. But for our son's true fans, his grandparents, we wanted something even more immediate and private. We share photos to our parents' iPhones with Apple's photo streams, and it works wonderfully. When you share a picture, an alert pops up on everyone's phones. It's almost like you're texting a photograph to a group, but you're also creating an archive that you can look back through. If you've got relatives who don't use the iPhone, though, you'll need another solution. Last, we created a photo set on Yahoo's Flickr to share with our widest circle of friends and colleagues, even though its mobile experience didn't match the other services. It's a lot of work. So why do we go to all this trouble in the first place? A friend told me as I approached fatherhood that it was easy to talk about the hard things in parenting. I mean, they're obvious. Sleep deprivation, a foreclosing of social possibilities, diapers. But the beauty of it can't be captured in words. These photographs and the stories they tell are an attempt to make meaning out of the rewarding difficulties of rearing a child. The internet companies know how prized these photographs are. Most people will never post anything that gets more likes and favorites than their baby photographs. And the companies translate that interest into advertising inventory. And just as retailers like Target try to become part of parents' new normal shopping habits, web companies know that your digital habits are up for grabs too. Where you post your baby photographs is the biggest endorsement of a social network that you can make. The family that Facebooks together might not stay together, but they will stay on Facebook. Which reminds me of one last piece of advice. While it might seem like Google and Yahoo have been around forever, while it might seem like the cloud is firmly established, nothing on the internet is on firm footing over the long haul. And due to the nature of competition these days, the world's technology titans have strategically broken the connections between their networks. So don't trust any web company to act as the sole archive for your photos. Back up those kid pictures onto a hard drive or make an old-fashioned album of prints. Long after the likes and favorites have faded away, you want to preserve the memories. And I wouldn't trust any web company to keep things as they are until my child's graduation from kindergarten, let alone high school.
Alexis Madrigal is a senior editor at The Atlantic and a visiting scholar at Berkeley's Center for Science, Technology, Medicine, and Society. There are great ball players, and then there's Ted Williams. In a 22-year career with the Boston Red Sox, Williams staked a credible claim to being the greatest hitter who ever lived. But he also was a tormented soul who hurt a lot of people, including himself. Williams is the subject of the new biography, The Kid, by our next guest, Ben Bradley Jr. Williams won 6 batting titles, including one when he was 40. He's the last player to hit 400 in a season, and he retired with baseball's highest on-base percentage ever. Williams hit for power, too. His 521 career home runs places him among the top 20 of all time, despite missing three seasons serving in World War II and most of two more seasons serving as a pilot in Korea. But Williams's personal life was a mess. Though he quietly committed countless acts of kindness and generosity, he also railed at sports writers, cursed and spat at fans, and took out his rage on those closest to him. And in a truly bizarre ending to his life story, his son had his head and body cryonically frozen, generating a bitter family dispute that played out in the Boston media. Author Ben Bradley Jr. spent 25 years as a reporter and editor at the Boston Globe. He spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies last Tuesday.
Well, Ben Bradley Jr., welcome to Fresh Air. Now, Ted Williams decided at a very early age he was going to be one of the greatest hitters of all time, right? But what was he like physically, and how did he get so good?
Well, he was a tall string bean and weighed nothing. He always thought he was too skinny and weak, but he was just an incredible hitter. He had a textbook swing, low to high. He always emphasized that you had to have a slight uppercut in your swing. He ended up pioneering the notion that sluggers didn't need to use a big heavy bat, that a lighter bat was better because it created more whip, and the speed of the bat hitting the ball, the speed of the swing, like a golfer's speed of the swing, is what really generates the power. And he also had fantastic eyesight, unusual eyesight and reflexes. But he didn't like it when people suggested that his success was simply due to his natural talent. He said no one ever swung a bat more often than I did. No one practiced harder than I did. So he always attributed a lot of his success to hard work.
Ted had a lot of anger. This man's childhood wasn't easy. Tell us about his mom.
Well, his mother was a Salvation Army street worker, a zealot, really. And she was out until all hours of the night saving souls on the street. And this is what she believed in. That was her passion in life, more so than taking care of her two sons, Ted and his younger brother, Danny. The father was a sort of a drunk and a ne'er-do-well and not around. And his mother not being present caused Ted a lot of resentment and anger. I think that was the source of the anger. And he had, luckily for him, a playground right down the street, which had lights, which was unusual in those days. So he was able to spend much of the time on the ball field. But he nursed this anger and resentment, and these were festering early memories for him.
So the family was poor, and there's another aspect of his childhood that Ted never was very comfortable with, and that was his ethnic heritage, his mom's. Tell us about that.
Well, I think this is one of the most interesting parts of the Williams story, and it's something that didn't come out until a month before Ted died in 2002, the fact that he was a Mexican-American. His mother was Mexican. He was born in Mexico. Her parents were born and raised there as well. And he was embarrassed about this and afraid that the prejudice of the day would hurt his baseball career. And he always spoke rather contemptuously of his extended family on the mother's side and referred to them as the Mexicans in not a nice way. And there was a very telling moment in 1939 after Williams had completed his rookie year with the Red Sox and had made an absolutely smashing debut, hit well over 300 and led the league in runs batted in. And he returned to San Diego, the conquering hero, and was met at the train station by a gaggle of 100 or so of the extended Mexican clan. And Ted took one look at them from afar and beat a hasty retreat. He didn't want to be seen with them.
He played his entire career at Boston and had a contentious relationship with the fans to a degree and certainly with sports writers for all of those years. But there was this other side of him, visiting kids in the hospital and not telling anybody about it.
Yeah. This is a very important side of Ted Williams. his anger got a lot of the attention, but that anger was really leavened by a fundamental kindness and decency. He had a good heart. His outlet for showing this chiefly was sick children with cancer. And in those days, cancer for children was almost always fatal. And Williams would go and quietly visit these kids. And he would insist that there be no publicity. But if the writers came to find out about it, and they would ask him about it, he would say, yeah, it's true, but if you write it, I'll never talk to you again. This was genuine, and he didn't want any ink for it.
You know, we could spend an hour talking about his great moments as a hitter, but one that we probably should discuss is the incredible season he had in 1941. He hit a home run to win the All-Star game, and then he had a chance to hit 400, which no one has done since. And tell us about that approaching the last day, where his average was, and the decision about whether to play a doubleheader.
Well, this was really his defining moment as a player. He entered into the final two games of the year. It was a doubleheader in Philadelphia, and he was hitting 399.6. So the average would have been rounded up on the books, but he knew for his legacy that he had to play. He didn't want to back into 400.
So he could have sat out the day and technically
he could have sat out the day and it would have gone on the books as 400, but with an asterisk, you know, and he might have been criticized for it. He knew. But his manager, Joe Cronin, was telling the writers as the day approached that he might bench the kid to protect his average. It was late September. The shadows in the park in Philadelphia were a factor. Connie Mack was pitching two rookie pitchers that Williams wasn't familiar with.
And we should just note that this was a season that had gotten such attention. He'd been on the cover of Life magazine, right? He would get standing ovations at Yankee Stadium, of all places. So this was the story of the year. After Joe DiMaggio's,
except for Joe DiMaggio's
56-game hitting streak, which was maybe even more amazing, but was over by the time Ted was approaching the end of the season with a shot at 400.
Exactly,
so they put him in the lineup for a doubleheader. What happened?
Well, at his insistence, Ted said to Cronin, no way am I not playing this game. And not only did he play the first game, he played the second game. So in the first game, I forget exactly how many hits he got the first game. I believe three hits, including a home run. So by that time, he was safely over 400, maybe 402 or 3. And in between games, one of the writers came down and told Cronin exactly what his average was. And are you going to sit him now, Joe, for the second game? And Joe said, no, the kid insisted on playing the second game, too. So theoretically, he might have, if he went 0-for-4 in the second game, he could have slid back under 400, perhaps. He got another three hits in the second game, I believe, and on the day went 6-for-8. So it was really a courageous, defining moment for him.
Yeah, and he continued to do amazing things throughout his career, even though he was interrupted by going into the service in World War II and then again being called back and flew missions over Korea. He homered at his last at-bat, his last game. I mean, he's truly an immortal figure of the game. But he also had these amazing eccentricities. There was an account of his warm-up routine in the dugout. Do you want to describe this?
Well, yeah, he was certainly vain. And in addition to being good, Williams thought it was important to look good. And dating back to his childhood in San Diego, he would always be walking to school holding a bat. And sometimes he would pass a store and admire his reflection in the glass and take a swing or two. And the store managers inside would look out bemused at this kid admiring his reflection in the glass. And but Ted very candidly admitted that he didn't want to just be good. He wanted to look good, and it was important that he have a beautiful swing. So part of his pregame routine would be that he would often strip down to his wear a towel around his waist and some sandals. He would go stand in front of a mirror and take his cuts, and he'd be psyching himself up for the game, and he'd start, you know, he'd take a cut and then start murmuring under his breath, "I'm Ted Williams. Take a swing. I'm Ted Williams. I'm the best effing hitter in baseball."
Well, we have to talk about this truly bizarre chapter in Ted's life. Well, really, after the end of his life, when his, you know, his body was frozen for potential thawing, when medical technology advances, you know, the science is called cryonics. And before we talk about how that came to occur, I'd like you to just to describe what actually happened to Ted's body when he died in 2002.
Well, when he died, he was living in this remote section of Florida called Hernando, which is in between Tampa and Orlando and north central Florida, very remote. And John Henry, his son, had gotten interested in cryonics, and he decided that this was something that he wanted to have done with his father's body. So when the time came, the body was taken from the local hospital and taken to the nearest airport. The Alcor Life Extension Foundation, which is one of the leading practitioners of cryonics based in Arizona, that was the facility that John Henry had settled on. They flew a chartered jet in. And
this is after throwing packs of ice on the body to freeze it from the hospital bed in Florida, right?
Right. Well, that's a key staple to try and preserve the body until they actually perform the procedure. So his body was flown out to Scottsdale, Arizona, outside Phoenix, and then they started this 3 or 4 hour procedure, which was quite gruesome.
Well, let's talk about that. I mean, you want to describe what was actually done? I mean, you could choose to have simply your head preserved or your body or both.
Right. And in the world of cryonics, there are basically two options. One is called the whole body procedure, where essentially you have your entire body frozen. This is all in the attempt, in the belief that medical science will someday advance to the point where it'll be possible to cure you of whatever disease you died of and bring you back to life. It's widely dismissed, this theory, by most mainstream scientists, and it's, you know, a hope and a prayer. So there's the whole body, or there's what's called the neuro, which involves cutting your head off and saving just your head. The theory being that science by that time will have advanced to the point where it will be easy to generate tissue and you can grow a body underneath your head, or so the hope goes.
So what happened to Ted's body?
Well, John Henry decided that they would do the neuro. So his head was cut off, and they also decided people who have the neuro and just the head taken off usually dispose of the rest of the body and have it cremated. But they decided to keep Williams's trunk as well. So both are out there frozen today at Alcor.
And they're stored in these tanks that are called, what is the term?
Dewars. Dewars is what the Alcor people call them. It looks like if you ever toured a microbrewery, there are these big tanks hanging from the ceiling filled with liquid nitrogen cooled to something like, you know, minus 321 degrees Fahrenheit. And the bodies are kept in one tank, maybe about five or six to a tank. And the heads are put in what look like lobster pots inside what's called a neuro column, and they're kept in a separate, smaller tank.
One more thing. I've spent most of my career covering politicians and elected officials, and have observed over the years that the people who achieve at the highest level are often not exactly I don't know, normal, for lack of a better word. Not, mm-hmm. you know, people that do great things aren't necessarily the people I'd want to introduce my sister to. You know, and I've always wondered whether people's achievements are tied to their demons. And with Ted, you see such extraordinary athletic achievements and just such a troubled man. Do you think they're connected?
Well, I think in order to excel, sometimes you have to be single-minded in your determination to succeed, and other things suffer along the way. And he was that. He ignored, he put family life aside, and he was absolutely determined to become the greatest hitter that ever lived. And he was driven to excel, and not just in baseball. It turned out that he was a world-class fisherman as well. He learned photography. He became a Top Gun Marine fighter pilot. And John Glenn, no less, called him one of the greatest pilots he'd ever seen. Anything that he undertook, he wanted to do right. He was a perfectionist, and he had no tolerance for those who did things in what he felt were a shoddy manner. And he was in a zone, really, his entire life. And when you're in a zone like that, a lot of other things, you can break a lot of china along the way.
Well, Ben Bradley, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Ben Bradley Jr. spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies. Bradley's new biography of Ted Williams is called The Kid. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Sharrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our assistant producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancooley.